Okay, my guest today on Podcasting Softly and rounding off the interviews regarding this wonderful, wonderful release from Arrow is a wonderful package that put together the re-release of Waterworld. My guest is writer, director, producer, the man who kicked it all off, you might say, Peter Rader, also responsible for films like Grandmother's House, Hired to Kill, wonderful books like Playing to the Gods, Mike Wallace, wonderful books as well. He's also responsible for the story behind The Last Legion, another movie, another good movie. Peter, your ears must have been burning, my friend, because when I was interviewing Daniel Griffith, who's the maker of Maelstrom, which is the wonderful behind-the-scenes documentary featured on this disc, I was talking about you. Your ears must have been burning.
Yeah, I think that Daniel did a great job. He approached us about 3 months ago or so, you know, explaining that he had been contracted to do a behind-the-scenes doc, you know, coinciding with the 4K release of Waterworld. And we're all a little hesitant, us who have been involved in the Waterworld story, because so much of the press coverage was kind of a shark feeding frenzy, if you will. And so, you know, I said, well, okay, you know, I'll do it if Kevin Reynolds does it.
Okay.
So he like had to go try to get Kevin Reynolds, and, you know, but he ended up getting practically everyone. And I think he did a really great job because he was interested in telling sort of the creative story rather than the political story behind Waterworld.
Yeah.
And, you know, creatively, it was quite an undertaking. Nothing had been done quite like that. The idea of doing the entire movie and shooting it practically on water rather than on a stage or in a tank was audacious, you know?
Yeah, totally.
So,
now, the reason I said your ears must have been burning is because in said interview with Daniel regarding his documentary, I mentioned that when I first started doing this podcasting thing a few years back, and I was sort of at odds with what to do because they sort of gave me, they didn't give me any parameters what they wanted, and I just finished watching Waterworld, and I thought I love Waterworld so much as a film, I really wanted to talk to someone, and I figured, well, who could I get, you know, and how do I get them? And so I just happened to see you on Facebook, and I wrote a very long plea to talk to you. And I wasn't trying to explain that I wasn't interested in talking about anything negative, but mainly the creative journey that you took writing the film, and also that the development of it. But and it's ironic that the next morning you sent me a little message simply saying sure.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because I don't even check messages that often on Facebook, but I just happened to see your I was like, why not? Let's do this. It'll be fun. I actually I have a lot of despite it being It was both one of the most wonderful experiences of my career and also one of the most horrific at the same time,
Yeah.
It was the first script I ever wrote,
yeah.
And I was so naive and so fearless that I just kind of went for it. And, it was sort of a Cinderella story, I didn't even have an agent when I wrote it. Then like 3 weeks later, I had like a major agency. I had a 2-2 script deal and I was suddenly, right in the middle of Hollywood development hell.
Yeah.
And it was really exciting,
Yeah. Well, we have a little bit of crossover in the fact that the man who came into the picture, the man that sort of has been credited with giving you the challenge of Mr. Cravoy, was also associated with a friend of mine, Matt Greenberg, who wrote 1408 and Reign of Fire at the time. And he was, Matt was like, curious because, every time he would go in for a meeting, Mr. Cravoy would tell him stories about how Matt would pitch ideas apparently. And he'd say, oh no, I got that beat. I got this guy working on this script called, it's like Mad Max on Water. So you need to come up with something better than that.
That's so funny, because he turned me down. Brad, that's so Brad. That's very funny. He turned me down flat. I mean, the you know, oft-repeated story, which has been reported in the press a couple of times, I'll just give you the elevator pitch of it, was, you know, Brad was working for Roger Corman at the time, and he was hustling away, and it was the sort of AFM era where everyone was getting foreign pre-sales, and he said, I've got some South African money. If you come up with a Mad Max ripoff, I'll let you direct it. And there were two moral dilemmas in that query. One was I willing to accept the South African blood money, because apartheid was still in full force at the time? And unfortunately, the answer to that question was yes. Being a Hollywood whore and young 20-something that totally wanted to break in. But the second question was I willing to do a ripoff of something that was so tired at that point? You know, everyone was doing the same old, you know, post-apocalyptic, in the desert, cheap, rusty Mad Max ripoffs. And, you know, I kind of thought about it and said, what if we spun it in a completely different direction? I said, let's do it on water. And then he just laughed me out of the room. He said, that's crazy. That would cost $5 million. I'm not going to make that movie. Get out of here. And then, you know, I love that
story, the fact that he said, you know, 5 million, you know, and when looking at it in the context of how much it would eventually go on to cost, he was I don't know if I'd like to see that $5 million version or not. It might be a bit scant.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've seen some of the press surrounding this 4K release, and there is so much admiration for the fact that, you know, almost all the stunts were practical. I mean, they actually did. They had the wave runners, and they had the zip lines, and they were, you know, and then, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that Waterworld has endured is because Universal has actually made buckets of money on Waterworld, just to set the record straight. Waterworld is actually one of the most successful franchises in Universal history, because they turned it into a theme park attraction, which began at Universal City here in Los Angeles, and then has since expanded, I think it's to 5 different locations. So Osaka, Dubai, Florida, and I forgot what the 5th one is, but where they're running this Waterworld stunt show, you know, 5 times a day to an arena that seats, you know, 1,500 people. So they're raking in money. To this day, the stunt shows are playing all over the world.
Yes, and plus there was a dearth of, like, merchandise, which I still cling to tenaciously. I mean, there was novelizations, there was comic books, video game, action figures. You know, they didn't half-ass it in terms of you know, putting the film out there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and there's kind of this kind of cult, you know, following at this point. I mean, you know, thank you so much for saying that you enjoy the film, but, you know, I honestly, that's the reaction that I mostly get. Most people say they really like the film, you know, even though it took this bashing in the press in 1995. But I think a lot of people have a lot of affection for that film.
Yeah, and I mean, I have always, I mean, it's more difficult today than it was then to avoid any of the press and reviews and things like that of movies before you see them, you know, I mean, because 9 times out of 10 today, you've seen, like, a good chunk of the movie before you even get to the movie. I mean, there's trailers and TV spots and,
yep,
and so much, you know, so much marketing. Back then, it was easy to avoid. So going in, I had no idea of the bad press and all that sort of thing. I simply went to the movies, as I often did. The only thing I'd seen was at that point was the teaser trailer, which I found was fascinating. And, you know, coming from the land of Mad Max, as I do, the idea of Mad Max on water was pretty darn appealing to me. I was like, that's great, that's so different, because, as you said, by that point, Mad Max, you know, a lot of Italian rip-offs. They were kind of just they were the, they'd kind of seen their day, and they weren't getting any better. And and so the idea of a similar concept but in a completely different environment than some sort of you know, post-nuke or post-devastation wasteland desert, you know, ruined city sort of thing was really refreshing, I thought, anyway.
Well, the irony is that if you do a straight ahead Mad Max ripoff, it actually can be a fairly inexpensive movie. I mean, all you need is a desert and a bunch of rusted out vehicles. You don't need a lot of lighting equipment. You know, get some reflector boards and you're good to go, and a handheld camera. You know, and just bang it about a bit. You know. But suddenly, if you change that one element, you set it on water, it becomes, you know, whatever, $175 million action movie, which was, I think, the most expensive movie to date at that point, and it held that record for 5 minutes until, like, I think what that Batman one with Schwarzenegger eclipsed us in 2 minutes later, and then every movie is now, you know,
Yeah.
that price tag.
We live in an era of currently when there's a lot of talk about fake news. When I did finally come to read all of the material, like after I'd seen Waterworld, I wanted to know everything about it that I could because I loved it so much. Eventually, there would come a book by a gentleman named Robert pa sorry, James Robert Parrish, and he wrote a book simply titled "Fiasco: A History of Hollywood's Most Iconic Flops," and of course, Waterworld and The Postman and Ishtar, Cleopatra, Popeye—they're all in there. And you know, in doing research for these interviews and watching the documentary, it was kind of nice to see some of those outlandish stories finally dispelled. Like, for instance, the most famous one is the set sunk.
Right. It's just one of those things, fake news, you know, one person spreads it and then everyone latches on to that rumor. Yeah, you know, that book, was I quoted in that? I think that was one of the interviews that I was tricked into, if I was, you know, where the guy says, "Oh, I want to write about Waterworld, but it's a book about the flops of Hollywood." Yeah. So that's why
No, you can feel
we were a little cautious with Daniel Griffith. You know, we were a little cautious before we
You
gave Mark
can
a chance, but he ended up being a good guy.
you can rest assured there's no direct quotes from you in it. I mean, he basically took probably the details from your interview, like how you came to write it, and then, you know, he's mainly concerned, like, there's obviously a lot of research in there that came from probably press of at the time. I mean, there's a lot of he seems to be more concerned with how much things cost, and you know, because the I mean, there's a rumor in there that must have been perpetuated at the time that the whole set sinking thing cost the production something like $500,000 to refloat the set. I mean, there's some pretty exacting numbers that he got from somewhere. You know, and plus the other story, I think, that was dispelled, the fact that Kevin Costner had like a $40,000 yacht or something to ferry him the 400 yards out from where he was staying to the set every day or something like that. So a lot of, you know, it paints as most of these stories do, sort of lumping these really great, some of these are really tremendous films, and simply turning them into tales of Hollywood hubris.
Well, you know, the famous story about the creation of Century City out here in Los Angeles is that was based on the disaster that we from the 1960s called Antony and Cleopatra, the Liz Taylor, Richard Burton movie that, you know, cost probably much more than Waterworld in real dollars at the time and was a disaster. And to pay for it, Fox had to sell part of its backlot, and that became Century City, you know, one of the key areas of downtown of Los Angeles, where all the lawyers now have their offices.
So anyway, some burning questions I've had for you for a couple of years regarding your initial, I mean, I know that, like you say in the documentary and like you've said, this was your, it's wow, it's kind of wild. Like there's been some great stories of like first scripts from writers that I've spoken to, and this is a pretty ostentatious, audacious debut for a scriptwriter to have been the writer of this film that is both famous, infamous, a cult movie in some ways. So some of the concepts that I that came through in the documentary and also from some reading about some of the stuff that you initially came up with that was obviously pared back for whatever reason. And it was brought up in the documentary. There was a lot of pardon me, a lot more sort of religious type theme running through it, like, and there's some elements still left of it, like, for instance, there's a pretty big one at the end where he's talking to the survivors before he goes to the D's to save Enola again. He says to them, the world wasn't created in a deluge, it was covered by it. And someone yells out, blasphemy, I just wondered if there was the remnants of anything that you had in your initial draft regarding, like, a type of a religious, sort of like a something that a type of religion or a type of how should we say, spirituality that grew out of this society.
Right. So when one creates these mythic alternate universes, and I have done a bunch of them, and almost all of them have not gotten made because they're so expensive, you have to write the entire, you have to create society from scratch and figure out all aspects of it, including religion and superstition and, rituals and belief systems and social structure, and all of that stuff needs to actually be worked out. Like, how does this world actually work? How do they eat? What currency do they trade? And all these types of things. So in that thinking, of course, was, what are people's belief systems around the creation of the world? And there were, I wouldn't call it religious as much as mythic.
Right.
I've always loved mythology and, use it in most of the things that I write. So I was, in one draft, we actually called, dry land, was called Ararat, after the Noah's Ark myth, where Noah's Ark landed, which is
Right.
somewhere in Turkey. And there were some sort of hints at those stories of origin in there, sprinkled throughout. But I also had a bunch of Greek mythology. At one point, the bad guy was called Poseidon, he held a trident
Right.
and sat on a clamshell throne. We
Right.
kind of were searching for the tone for a while,
Yeah.
And then they sort of, when David Tui came in, they sort of went into this kind of, rusty kind of post-apocalyptic, more traditional tone. I was trying to be a little bit more fanciful in my
Yeah.
original tones.
Yeah, and I believe that, and this is prior to like some of the stuff that was in Pirates of the Caribbean. I believe you had some sort of concept where people were like more mutated, like something about a dude with a crab arm or and stuff like that.
Yep, there was one of the henchmen of the villain was had a crab arm, had a enlarged that was attached to his body somehow prosthetically,
Right.
and in addition to the Mariner's Guild and things like that. Yeah, I thought it would be fun to experiment with that a little bit more,
Did
just
you?
in terms of what it's like eye candy. It's stuff that you never see in movies. That's what we're always striving to do, is to give you something, wow, haven't seen that before, you know.
Yeah.
So there were some ideas like that.
Mm. So was there any, like, further, like, as you're developing this story, like, where the Mariner came from, or is he simply, like, sort of the outlaw Josie Wales, like, or High Plains Drifter? He doesn't have a... Did you develop anything regarding, like, his past and where he came from, and if there are more...
Sure.
You know?
Sure. There were a number of drafts that had flashbacks of how he lost his wife and child, and, you know, in a savage attack by the smokers. But ultimately, it was decided that it's more interesting to have him just be mysterious.
Right.
You know, kind of like Shane. You know,
yeah.
which Shane for sure is a template. I mean, I always say that Waterworld is a Western.
Yeah.
But you know, Shane is just the mysterious, you know, kind of drifter who comes into town and, you know, and, you know, helps the homesteaders fend off the bad guys, and then he disappears and he goes away, and that's sort of a mythic archetype, you know, the loner. Kind of more interesting sometimes than to spell out exactly what happened to him, you know what I mean?
Right. And from your original draft, the whole thing of where they have like almost a burial ceremony in the film with this recycling thing where they dump them into that pool of goodness knows what it is, toxic waste or something.
Right, the organobarge.
Yeah.
Yeah, that actually was not in, that was from another writer. I'm not even sure which writer.
Right.
I don't know if David came up with that, but it was one of the writers that followed me that came up with that idea.
Right.
Which is, you know.
Yeah, because I was going to say that this, you know, like, what was that stuff? Like, ugh. You know, because Kevin spends, I thought, you know, he spends out, I was sort of watching, they go, oh man, what is that stuff, and is it like corrosive or something, but he gets out of it all right, and I thought, man, he's got to be glad to like jump in the water and wash that crap off, whatever it is, man, because it looked pretty gross.
Right.
But, you know, so, I mean, in the wake of something like this, which is like a huge beginning into one's screenwriting career. I mean, it wasn't the complete failure that as it was reported. Was there ever any talk of, you know, let's do another one?
Funny you should ask. David Tui and I, are you listening, Universal? David Tui and I have been discussing pitching a sequel. It's
right.
Time for Waterworld 2, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, just think of what's been reported just in the last few months. I think there was a report in the last couple of weeks that, you know, the water temperatures have been rising much faster than we thought. I think, you know, 400% faster or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, Waterworld, actually, you know, my original draft for Waterworld was 86, so it was way ahead of its time in terms of, you know, this kind of global warming thing. Movie was eventually made in 95, but, you know, now it's so a part of the sort of just the zeitgeist, this whole idea of, you know, water, the water temperature rising and the ice caps melting and what calamity that's going to cause. So, you know, we're thinking it's time for a sequel, and we have a really interesting take on it. But can't tell you about that just yet.
That's okay. Take all my money now. I don't care. I want to see it. Yeah, that's fantastic. But I often when I speak to screenwriters, they talk about things that survive, like because you know you did so much work, and then of course as is often the case, you someone else is brought in to polish. I think is the polite word for it, or do some more writing because you've kind of reached your battery life as far as being the writer on it, and they bring on, you know, someone else or maybe someone who has a bit more of a name so they can put a name on the script that people will respond to, because you know in most cases sometimes a lot of these are first time writers like you were then. But you said one of the things that survived all of the drafts and is in the movie is the peeing. It starts off with him drinking his own whiz.
Yeah, that was the first scene in my script, and it never changed. It was in every draft of everyone's script because it's such an iconic, you know, movies are a visual medium, and we always say show, don't tell. Whenever you can show something with pictures rather than words, you know, that's so much stronger than using exposition and people, you know, yakking about things like that. No. So I always thought, you know, I mean, there's is it Samuel Taylor Coleridge's poem, water, water everywhere, but not a drop to drink. Okay, how do you show that? Water everywhere. So the first idea was, you know, as soon as Universal took the script, it's like, my God, let's use the logo, let's use the world, you know, let's actually zoom in on that planet and show that all the continents have disappeared. So that's, you know, and then go in and descend on the ship. And then the next thing is, you know, there's water everywhere, but none, it's all, you know, sailing. It's a, you know, you can't drink it. So what do you do about that? Well, what if he's got this device, this contraption? We show that right away, and we show how precious, you know, every drop is. So yeah. I'm proud of that scene. I love that scene.
Yeah. And he played it to the hilt too. Like he does like squeeze every drop out of it and even like licks the tap and make sure he gets like every bit out of it that's possible. But I bring it up because that was kind of like this nice memory, because I mean I saw it in the cinema when it first came out, and that was the bit where the movie lost my mother. My mother was with me, my whole family was with me, and we're watching it, and she came out and she said, "Oh my God," she said, "what a way to start a movie, a guy drinking his own piss." she said that just did me in, and I thought, wow, so you only had like an hour and 40 something minutes left to go. but she was that complete, and she said, "Did you like that movie?" I said, I loved it. She said, "Well, that's good that you liked it, but oh," she said, "that's terrible." She said, "Oh God," she said, "I hope we don't live to see that come to fruition." See that come to fruition, because I'm not too keen on the fact that I might have to one day, you know, whiz in a cup when I need like a, you know, to make a cup of coffee or something like that, because there's no water, you know. So
well, the thing is, you can't please everyone. And you know, my wife is a really talented filmmaker, and we have a production company together, and we make films together. And I always tell her, you know, on any given film, 30% are going to love it, 30% are going to hate it, and you know, 40% in the middle. Those are the people that you really need to please, because you got the ones on this end, and you're never going to get the ones on that end. It's like the Olympics when they vote on the dives. You know, they always eliminate the high score and the low score, and they take the average of all the other scores, because you know, sometimes you just, yeah, it's all about sensibilities, you know. And I guess it's totally, you know, well, it was your thing, it wasn't your mom's thing.
Yeah. But no, it's I absolutely love the film, and I loved it since I seen it. I still love it today. This is a marvelous release. Daniel's made a wonderful as I said to him, it was all in my heart of hearts. If I ever got the opportunity, I said I hoped someone would make a film that told the creative story, not the media bash story, behind this wonderful, wonderful movie. And whether it was, call it fake, call it luck, call it karma, not 4 hours after I finished talking to him, you got my message. And I finally, after 3 years, got to do the interview that I was going to kick off this whole thing with, and talk about one of my favorite movies of all time with the man who kicked it all off, Peter Rader. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you, and an absolute pleasure to have you as my guest on Podcasting Them Softly.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you. And good luck, and can't wait to hear all your other podcasts.
That's great. And you know, I know you can't talk about that sequel, but just rest assured, you've got my the price of admission. I have it for you right now. I don't care, because I think it. I think not only is it timely and maybe more topical today than it maybe was then, but and probably today it won't be made on the. I mean, obviously there's CGI to help it a lot today, but Waterworld for its time needs to be appreciated for the fact that it was one of the last like big movies where they built everything, and everything you see on screen is there, and it's absolutely incredible to
That's my dog there.
that's
I
all
think that's
right.
time to say it's a wrap.
But
Okay. So nice to talk to you.
yeah, absolutely. Take care, Peter, and I wish you all the best, mate, with all that you've got cooking, and I hope that that sequel finds the light of day at some point.
I'll leave you with one little snippet.
Okay.
Guess who the hero? Guess who the hero of the sequel is?
Enola?
That's right, my friend. It's time for a female lead. Enola is her movie.
Very cool. Very cool. I like it. I
Okay.
love it. Take care, my friend.